Made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where the U of I Department of Theater presents the Tennessee Williams play, Spring Storm, opening April 1st, and the Department of Dance presents choreography of its students in Studio Dance 2, April 22nd through 24th. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
It's 107 Central Time, and you're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL, AM 580. I'm Jay Pierce. Celeste Quinn returns tomorrow. Harriet Williamson is the producer of the program. We had some assistance today from Travis Stancil, and Jason Croft is our technical director. Well, on this hour of today's program, we remember Alistair Cook, the legendary British broadcaster, died early yesterday, just weeks after retiring, at age 95. Alistair Cook was perhaps best known for his weekly Letter from America on the BBC, which has aired Monday afternoons at 2:40 here on AM 580. Among other things, Cook hosted Masterpiece Theater on PBS for more than 20 years. The BBC prepared a special remembrance, and we'll take a listen. And then we'll open up the phone lines in about a half hour, and you can call in and relate your own thoughts or remembrances. Again, that'll be coming up in a half hour, so as your thoughts come up during this special program from the BBC, get them ready, and then we'll take your phone calls in just about a half hour. First, this special from the BBC.
Mr. Cook was known to millions of listeners through his program Letter from America, which was broadcast by the BBC for 58 years in Britain and around the globe. It was by far the longest-running radio series of its kind in the world. Alistair Cook, who was born in Britain but who later took US citizenship, also spent many years as the correspondent in America for Britain's Guardian newspaper, and he hosted a number of acclaimed television series. Poor health forced Mr. Cook to retire from broadcasting earlier this year. Since the news of his death was announced, tributes have been pouring in, from the British Prime Minister and from fellow broadcasters. Now, the BBC presenter James Naughtie presents a special programme on the extraordinary life and work of Alistair Cook. It begins with a characteristically wry observation from the late Mr. Cook himself.
I'm sure you expect me to say, I'm sorry not to be with you. Well, on the whole, I'm not sorry. I believe that radio broadcasters should be heard and not seen. I don't want to disturb whatever pleasing image any of you may have of me. So you see why I'm not over anxious to be with you today. And as I patter into the room, hear a massive intake of breath, a shock of recognition that the man you've chosen to honor bears an appalling resemblance to King Lear in the last act.
Alistair Cook was the quintessential radio broadcaster, but he was more than just a journalist. Here was a Renaissance man whose world encompassed the great newspapers, television as well as radio, Hollywood in its heyday, an essayist for whom jazz, piano and golf were as rich a part of life as politics. He was the Englishman who became an American, an institution on both sides of the Atlantic. For his listeners and for all of us here at the BBC, he was a voice of distinction, a radio craftsman. My colleagues Nick Clark, who's also Cook's biographer, and Tony Grant, his London producer.
Well, it's a wonderful voice to listen to, and, you know, you just have to read the letters that come in to know that it's the voice as much as anything else that people like. Obviously, he's a master storyteller, and he's wonderful the way he stitches together these 2,000-word letters from America. They go from subject to subject to subject, and then at the end it all comes together and you realise what he was talking about, usually.
Towards the end of his life, Alistair, I'm sure, was staying alive to do the letter. And he got up in the morning and he started thinking about the letter. And when he'd done the letter, he stopped thinking about it, had a glass of whiskey, watched some more television, and the following morning he would be thinking about the following week's letter. It was the thread of his life. It is the story of his life.
Alistair Cook's long life had an element of daring from the beginning, yet his background of itself gave him no automatic advantages. He was born Alfred in 1908 in the north of England to Samuel and Margaret Cook. His father was at first a factory worker. His older brother Sam became a butcher. His upbringing, as described by his stepdaughter Holly Rumbold, was austere.
His parents lived in Salford outside Manchester, and his mother suffered from lung trouble. So they moved to Blackpool so she could be by the sea. And I think his father did too. I think they both had TB. They were very, very Methodist, very strict. There were no playing cards in the house, no drink or anything like that. No cigarettes, certainly. His father was a lay preacher, which is perhaps where he got the gift of the gab.
It was a solid world that left its mark, but the young Cook wanted release. American troops were billeted with his family during the First World War, and soon after, American films began to arrive in Britain. His imagination stirred, and despite some family disapproval, cinema became a passion. And then, with the help of an inspirational headmaster at his school in Blackpool, he was on his way to Cambridge University, his northern accent gone and the world opening up. He edited the university newspaper, acted and ran a drama group, and still found time to get a first-class degree in English. He even managed to become Cambridge drama critic for the Manchester Guardian at the age of 20. It was the paper he wanted to write for, just as he wanted to broadcast for the BBC. He was self-confident enough to write to the corporation suggesting that he might be useful as a critic, and probably seemed rather pompous in doing so. Not surprisingly, perhaps, the BBC didn't jump at the chance. Then along did come the opportunity that would shape his life. He won a Commonwealth Fund fellowship to study in the United States. It was 1932, and he was off.
One of the great things about the fellowship was that you obviously went to your university and you stayed there through the winter and the spring. You had to buy a car, and they made that extremely easy. Also, cars cost $60. And drive around as many of the states as you could. So the summer tour was a total revelation. The trip around the country, which I did, which took, what, June, July, August, 4 months, I found that America was far more dramatic than Broadway. And I sort of, I think I, without saying it to myself, felt a whole career opening up.
In the course of that first trip, his love affair with the United States was consummated. All around him were the extraordinary characters of the age, Gershwin and Copeland, Hemingway and Chaplin, who made it an irresistibly alluring and exciting place. Jazz was everywhere, the skyscrapers were climbing higher, and Hollywood was booming. For someone of his cast of mind and of his age, it was a kind of heaven.
He belonged to the great period of jazz, the period I like myself, the early Armstrong period, Ellington, and this was the kind of jazz that he liked.
That was Charles Chilton and Duke Ellington on one of Alistair Cook's first records, a jazz 78, of course. Chilton himself later became a jazz man and a broadcaster, but when he and Cook first worked together in 1938, he was in the gramophone library at the BBC. Finally, the corporation had given way to the endless entreaties from that ambitious young man who'd first written from Cambridge. His first BBC radio series, inevitably perhaps, was about American music. It was called I Hear America Singing.
We used to go on the air, I think, at 9 o'clock, and he used to arrive about six. And so he starts typing his script, and I'm looking out records, and while he's typing his script, I'm playing him records. And he's typing his script and listening to records at the same time and deciding whether he's going to include them or not. And when we go into the studio, I mean, the script is red hot. In fact, sometimes it wasn't even finished. Then the announcer would come in, light would flash, and say, now this evening we have another episode of I Hear America Singing by Alistair Cook, and here is Alistair Cook, and good evening, as he used to say.
Now he was a broadcaster. That didn't mean that his relationship with the BBC was easy. It wasn't then, and never really was. Cook was, after all, clever, outspoken, demanding, self-confident, and he wasn't someone who was ever going to be willing to settle down quietly in a comfortable niche. Before he went back to the United States, before the outbreak of the Second World War, he came up with an idea. He wanted to do a talk from America. The BBC saw nothing in it. My colleague and Cook's biographer, Nick Clark, describes how, after painful birth pangs, Letter from America came about.
He beavered away at the BBC to try and get them to give him one, and they wouldn't do. And eventually he got a programme called Mainly About Manhattan, which I think started in 1938. It was a 15-minute talk. Then it was axed. Then the war came. And he did other talks. There was a talk called American Commentary. He became an alternate presenter of that. It was 15 minutes long, this talk. And here he was with the thing that he'd found that perfectly crystallised the way that he liked to write. And eventually, after months and years of trying, in 1946, he finally persuaded the BBC to let him do a letter from America, although, as is not necessarily always recognised, the first ones were called American Letter. But we call it the first letter from America, which went out in March 1946. And then the first letter from America, named as such, was 3 or 4 years later.
So the letter was born. From the start, Cook was ambitious for it and spoke of it with great passion. He wanted it to be accessible to both shrewd bishops and honest carpenters, seeing it from the start as an important platform from which he could describe America to the British. And as well as broadcasting, his other ambition was being fulfilled. He was writing for the newspapers.
My headmaster told me that the highest honour that could ever befall anybody who won a school essay prize in the fourth form was to write one day, he said, for The Guardian. Well, I never anticipated it, but during the war, I was, just when the war was about to be over, I was going out to San Francisco to cover the founding conference of the United Nations for the BBC. I arrived there, and the next day I got a cable from a man I'd never heard of, named Alfred Wadsworth, asking me if I would take over and do a couple of pieces a day, just like that. Well, it turned out to be about 4,000 words a day, and it almost killed me, but that's how I started. Then he asked me if I'd be the UN correspondent, and then in 1948 if I'd become the first full-time correspondent that they'd ever had in the United States.
For almost 30 years, he combined his work for the BBC with writing for The Guardian, in a style which was as naturally discursive as the broadcasting voice he had developed. After Alfred Wadsworth retired in 1956, his editor on the paper, still based in Manchester in those days, was Alistair Hetherington.
In general, I thought of Cook that he did a very good job. Now, he did not deal it in the same way that most newspapers did. I mean, he sometimes did things several days later, but then when he did it, he gave us something more interesting, with more depth. I personally, as an editor, thought he was very, very good. I mean, Cook was really absolutely first class. There were occasions when we had rows with him. There were occasions when I thought he had not done the right thing. But on the occasions when that happened, it nearly always turned out that what he'd actually done was really quite a bit different to what anybody else had done.
In these years, as he wrote and argued and broadcast about America, Cook's mission was to explain the new world to the old, to clear away the clouds and reveal America as it was. It was a cultural as much as a political objective, and he became an important symbol of the transatlantic relationship, a kind of emblem of shared understanding. Raymond Seitz, an American diplomat for many years who was an admirer of Cook's long before he became ambassador in London in the early 1990s.
When Alistair Cook started off, you didn't have Friends on television and Frasier and, you know, all this stuff and all the movies that are around these days and all, you know, the McDonald's and, you know, all this kind of vast flood of Americana in Britain. So he really was a kind of ambassador from a foreign land, and he was explaining to his fellow countrymen these creatures from beyond the sea. And his balance in trying to get it right, trying to describe America, the warts and all, I think was a great contribution in transatlantic understanding.
This was a man embedded in America. He continued his odysseys round the United States, covering many of the major events of the 20th century for The Guardian and for the BBC.
In the movies, foreign correspondents are always where the action is. In life, it is not like that. Only by the wildest freak is a reporter, after many years on the hop, actually present at a single accidental convulsion of history. Mostly we write the coroner's inquest, the account of the funeral, the reconstruction of the prison riot, the trial of the spy, not the hatching of the plot. On the night of Tuesday, June the 4th, 1968, for the first time in 30 years, I found myself, by one casual chance in a thousand, on hand.
His friend, Richard Somerset Ward, who knew him through most of his adult life and into his later years, takes up this extraordinary story.
In May of 1968, the editor of The Guardian, Alistair Hetherington at that stage, called Alistair in America and said, "Don't bother to go to California for the primaries in June because our tennis correspondent is going through and he could certainly do what coverage we need." Well, Alistair, in fact, had arranged to go to California anyway in June to stay with his friend Nunnally Johnson, the great screenwriter. So he went, but for the only time in his life, he didn't take his typewriter. And on the night of the primaries, Nunnally Johnson said to him that he'd never seen primaries before and could they use Alistair's credentials, perhaps, to visit a hotel or two. And, of course, they wound up in the hotel where Robert Kennedy was. And they looked in, and there was this tremendous scrimmage of reporters from all over the world, and Alistair said, "Come on, we're getting out," and they walked out. But as they were going, Pierre Salinger saw him and said to him that the candidate would see him and took him through into the kitchen area behind to wait for the candidate to come down. And Alistair was probably about 10 feet from Robert Kennedy when he was shot to death. Alistair went back to Nunnally's home, and he wrote his dispatch in pencil on paper torn off a telephone pad.
There were splashes of flashbulbs and infernal heat, and the button eyes of Ethel Kennedy turned to cinders. She was wrestling or slapping a young man, and he was saying, "Listen, lady, I'm hurt too." And then she was on her knees, cradling him briefly. And in another little pool of light, on the greasy floor, was a huddle of clothes, and staring out of it, the face of Bobby Kennedy, like the stone face of a child's effigy on a cathedral tomb.
The assassination of Bobby Kennedy was one of the bloody moments that marked the period when America passed through the fire. From the shooting of President Kennedy in 1963, through the civil rights struggles of the mid-60s, into the tragedy of the Vietnam mire and the alienation of a whole generation. Then came the early 70s and the strange, potent story of Watergate. Cook was the elegant and sometimes impassioned commentator on those years of breakneck change, a revolutionary time. Nothing seemed permanent, no assumption was safe. He was majestic in these years. It doesn't mean that he was always right.
I think the surprising thing about Cook was the way he failed to come to grips with the major issues of the time. I felt his dispatches were bland. He was sitting on the fence.
Charles Wheeler, one of the BBC's most distinguished foreign correspondents, who spent much of the late 60s and early 70s in Washington.
I don't think he travelled the country. I didn't have the feeling, for example, during the black riots, that Cook knew what it was like to be in the middle of a black riot. Now, you can't expect him to be. He was a distinguished journalist. He was, I suppose, in those days, he was in his 60s, possibly in his 70s. And perhaps it's asking too much. But he was, I think, a bit remote from the real scene. And that came across, I think, in his broadcast, certainly to me.
And quite late in his career came the luxuriant flowering on television screens. Kenneth Clark had blazed a trail in the 60s with his series Civilization, an ambitious canter through the centuries using all the power of television by way of illustration. In 1972, Cook did it for the United States in the series called simply America. It was a phenomenon. The country, its people, its histories, its sinews were revealed. The pictures were entrancing, and the script was beautifully sculpted. Here, as he described that first sighting of the Statue of Liberty, was someone talking from the heart.
This is the grand and glorious cliché of America,
as the Acropolis is of Greece and the Taj Mahal of India. 1 million tourists have said there's nothing like it, and they're right. Many more millions of Europeans got their first view of it after the long steerage journey from Ireland or Italy or Russia. I was lucky. I came by choice.
Then, starting in 1970, he hosted a television series called Masterpiece Theatre, which presented British-made classics to Americans for the first time. It gave him the delicious opportunity to be the urbane guide and companion, the friend in the corner of the room who'd take you into a gentler and more gracious world. That Anglophile American diplomat Raymond Seitz was hooked.
Of course I watched Masterpiece Theatre. Everybody did. He was selected to do this, I'm sure, because he came across on television, on the public broadcasting system, which broadcast all these old British shows like Poldark and Upstairs, Downstairs. Great following in the U.S. I'm sure he was chosen because he seemed so quintessentially British. And these Masterpiece Theatre programs would begin at 8 o'clock in the evening, and there would be maybe 5 minutes of the camera lingering on Alistair Cook, and he would be sitting there with his silver hair and his tweed jacket and in his leather chair with these leather-bound books behind him, you know, the Englishman and his English club, and he just oozed Englishness.
Good evening. I'm Alistair Cook. We open tonight a new television theatre which in the next year will show you plays adapted from the works of Balzac, Henry James, Dostoevsky. Tonight we show you the first of 12 episodes about a great name in English history. Now all of us know, and those of us who survived the ordeal of the early 1940s, I think honour the last great Churchill. This is about the first, his ancestor, John Churchill, a professional soldier, son of a Dorset squire.
But for all of us at the BBC, and in the vast audience beyond, it was the letter that kept us in touch with Alistair Cook until the end. The letter was the longest-running continuous radio programme in the world, treasured in the BBC as a broadcasting gem. Naturally, it wasn't produced by some magical process, painless and perfect. Tony Grant was the London producer of Letter from America for many years. Cook would return for tennis or golf, usually, his great sporting passions, and record his letters at Broadcasting House.
For him, I think it was just another day's work, but for us, it was a major occasion when he'd come to Broadcasting House in London. And I used to go down there in reception and pace around nervously with a tie on, you know, with a great man about to arrive. And then he'd breeze in with his sort of pork pie hat on the top of his head, and he'd start moaning about London cabbies and how they didn't know the best route from Mayfair all of a mile away. And we'd go up to the studio and everything, you know, would have to be just so. We'd have a bottle of mineral water on the table. And we used to have this old lectern, and we used to keep it in the cupboard for 51 weeks of the year and then wheel it out and stick it on the table for him to rest his script on. And, well, once we got into the studio, of course, it would be customary for the producer or the person looking after the recording to have the script, you know. And so I'd say, Alistair, can I see the script then now? And he'd say, nope. Well, we knew he was going to say that. It's all a bit of a joke, really. So then we'd bowl on with the recording. And, you know, he was really very, very impressive. Some people you record, they make mistake after mistake after mistake. And with the new technology, of course, you can cut it all together and it sounds seamless. But he was virtually seamless anyway.
The recording ritual of Letter from America was often more complicated than its simple format might have let on. In the early years, it was recorded on 16-inch acetate disc at 33 RPM and was flown to London a couple of weeks ahead of transmission. But by the end of the century, he was talking over a digital line, which couldn't have been imagined when the first letter was written. It was inevitable that as time went by and the years added up, some listeners felt that Alistair Cook wasn't getting out as much as he should have and was dwelling a great deal on the past. There were complaints. But what a compensation we all had. Here was someone who could put contemporary events into a context that stretched back to the 20s. He was a history man at work. So when, in the second week of September 2001, he had to write one of his most difficult letters, he was able to see into the shadow of the past.
I turned on a 24-hour news station and saw a kind of movie I detest, of the towering inferno type, the roaring image of a monolith collapsing like a concertina in a vast plume of smoke. And just as I pressed my thumb to switch to the real world, I caught the familiar voice of a newsman and was in the appalling real world of Tuesday, the 11th of September, 2001. A date which to Americans will live in infamy along with the memories of Pearl Harbor, December the 7th, 1941, and the grievous day of President Kennedy's assassination.
For me, as with all my colleagues in broadcasting, it's impossible to think of Alistair Cook as anything other than a giant among us. That good morning or good evening, those wonderfully turned sentences and carefully entwined metaphors, those observations of FDR or Bogart or Nixon or Joe DiMaggio, above all the overwhelming commitment to language, to explanation, to description. With Alistair Cook, you were there. My colleague and Cook's biographer, Nick Clark.
Well, I think for sheer longevity, you'd have to say that he deserves a few medals. To be able to carry on the same type of broadcasting and continue to make it fresh and saleable to a broadcaster like the BBC for well over 50 years is something which never has been done before and surely never will be done again. He has been a great television star. He sold millions and millions of books. He was a talented pianist. He was an absolutely rubbish golfer, although he loved his golf and lied, I think, about the success that he'd achieved. And I think if you put all those things together and put behind them the one thing which I think marks him out from other long-running, long-serving journalists, this ability to coax contexts out of the wealth of his memory and his extraordinary breadth of his knowledge and to lay them out before you in a simple, understandable way is something which is rather sort of 18th century in its scope.
I would be ungrateful indeed if I forgot the people who really brought us here, and those are the millions, I hope, the millions, who are out there in the great beyond. And I mean the listeners who have grown old along with me. I have actually run into film actors with white hair who said, "My mother is a great fan of you." I said, "Never mind. Never mind your mother. How about you?"
Well, it was very nice to visit with you. Good night.
James Naughtie presented that tribute to the veteran broadcaster Alistair Cook, who's died at the age of 95. And there are a number of examples of Alistair Cook's work which you can view and hear on the internet at bbcnews.com.
And if you go to the BBC's website, you'll also be able to register, if you would like to, your thoughts about Alistair Cook, your remembrances, your comments. And we would also like to hear from you this afternoon. If you have listened to Alistair Cook over the years, perhaps watched him on one of his television programs or another appearance, our telephone numbers are 333-9455 here at WILL. 333-9455 is our local number. If it's a long-distance call, you can call us at 800-222-9455. 58 years and 2,869 letters from America. Some of the comments that have been posted to the BBC site: America has lost a great representative of British quality. How sad it is. Posted from Atlanta. From Boston, farewell. Your voice will never be silenced. Thank you for all the years of excellent broadcasting. From Kampala, Uganda, in his impressive style on radio, communicating in impeccable Queen's English, Cook has brightened my Sundays for close to 20 years. Now that he's gone, the only thing left for me to look forward to every Sunday will be the family lunch. I still cannot understand how he lived in America for nearly 60 years and still kept his English accent. I'll miss him Fare thee well, Alistair. Again, if you would like to talk about something about Alistair Cook that made you tune in on Monday afternoons on our radio station for Letter from America, our number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455, and we have a little over 10 minutes to take your calls. And we do have somebody calling in from Kankakee on line 4. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. Your caller is pleased to join in heaping praises on the late Alistair Cook, a most cheerful and pleasant man who communicated his highly perceptive and generous insights in the most accomplished manner. His work stands as a monument which will last and last. May his memory be eternal.
Well, great. Thank you very much for calling us. And from Kankakee came that call. If you would like to add to it, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or you can go online to the BBC's website, BBC. Well, the one site that you can get to this particular area would be the BBC site at www.bbc.co.uk, and then you can go to the World Service, and the link will take you to a listing of various programs, and go to Letter from America, and you'll find a lot of information about Alistair and some recordings of past letters, and also the comments that we've been reading a few of here, along with taking yours. And from Aurora on line 4. Hi, you're on the air on WILL. Go ahead, please.
Yes, dear Alistair, you so eloquently spoke about America and with endearment, and I thank you.
Bye-bye.
And thank you very much for the call. He made you feel there was a reason, that there was reason, and calm in the world, however bad the news, writes a listener from Nottingham in the UK to the BBC's site. From Seattle, Washington, I'll miss you, Mr. Cook. To me, you were an amazing radio journalist with your astute letter from America and as host for Masterpiece Theater. No one had a voice like yours, and you were an admirer yet astute observer of America. Thanks for all the many years of great journalism. It was fun. Someone writes from Athens, Greece. I first listened to Letter on BBC World in my late teens. It was one of the influences that eventually led me to 6 years in graduate studies and a lifetime relationship with the U.S. So long, Alistair Cook. I'm Jay Pierce. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. We have been listening to a program from the BBC, a special half-hour tribute to Alistair Cook, who passed away at the age of 95 early yesterday. Among other things, in his broadcasting career, he submitted his Letters from America for 58 years over the BBC, Radio 4, and on the World Service, which is picked up by many public radio stations across the country. We've been airing them Monday afternoons at 2:40. A note, because some of you have told me that it would be inconvenient for you to listen to this program at this time, we will be repeating it. The BBC tribute, that is, to Alistair Cook, at 6:30 this evening. So from 6:30 until 7, we will have a repeat of this program. But right now, if you'd like to call in with a memory or a tribute to Alistair Cook, 333-9455 is our number locally, or long distance. You can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. If there's something in particular about Alistair Cook, his voice, his manner, his perception, his wit on occasion, that you particularly remember and appreciate it, you can call in and join those letting us know. From the United States on the BBC site, I learned all about Watergate by listening to Alistair with my father in our living room in Madrid. The world has lost a cultural icon. And from the UK, over 60 years, Alistair Cook did more to foster an understanding of the phenomenon that is the United States than any other figure. His contribution has been incalculable. To my mind, he had more integrity and honesty in his little finger than any other communicator. You could always count on him for a thoughtful, elegant, and composed response to events. He was a very fine man and certainly one of the 100 greatest Britons We shall not see his like again. Rest easy, sir. Another comment about Alistair Cook from the BBC website. And again, if you would like to file yours, you can go to bbc.co.uk. That is their website. And you can find the section on there that leads you to Letter from America. Or you can call us now if you'd like to. We have just a few minutes here to spend talking about Alistair Cook. Again, at 6:30 this evening, we'll repeat the half-hour tribute from the BBC. 333-9455 locally, or 800-222-9455. And from Eureka, we have a caller again on line four. Go ahead, please.
Excuse me. Thank you for broadcasting this program. He was just such a wonderful, perceptive individual. I think it was good for us Americans to have a kind of outside, maybe objective look at ourselves, especially during some of the, I don't know what other way to put it, during the craziness of war and impeachment hearings and other things that we've gone through. But he always had something of depth to say to me, and I wish I had listened to him a lot more, but I respected the man, and he seems like such a decent individual with such a mind that one would cherish him as a friend just for his preceptivity about the world and his thoughts about life in general.
Well, thank you very much for your thoughts and your call today.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to a caller on line one. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My name is Malcolm Sargent. I was born in England in 1941, and I remember as a teenager, we didn't have a TV back in the 50s, but we used to listen to the radio, and Alistair Cook, Letter from America, was one of the highlights of the week. I just would like to say thank you.
Okay, and thank you very much for your call. The caller from Eureka brought up an interesting point about the perspective that you would gain of our own country from someone broadcasting from here, but over the BBC and observing America from a different perspective. There was someone who wrote into the BBC's website, "As an American, I learned more about my country from Mr. Cook's broadcast than from formal education, as clarity and attention to detail was refreshing and very welcome. Such statesmen seldom come our way. I, for one, shall miss him very much." And our number again. We have just about 5 minutes for you to get in if you'd like to make comments about Alistair Cook. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And you can call us right now. The lines are open on this special program on the Afternoon Magazine, diverting a bit from our norm, and broadcasting the half-hour tribute remembrance of Alistair Cook from the BBC. Again, we'll repeat that at 6:30 this evening for those for whom it was not convenient to listen at this time, or if you'd like to listen to it again, or call a friend and clue them in, tell them to listen. We still are, through the month of April, going to be broadcasting some of the archived letters from America at 2:40 in the afternoon. There are four more, I believe, if there are four more Mondays in April in that series to go. From England and the United States, as the 50-year-old product of an American-born mother, Alistair Cook showed me and many others our place in the world for many decades. His intellect and wit will be missed by many, a great broadcaster and communicator. Another comment from the BBC's website concerning Alistair. "I have been traveling a lot in recent years. The BBC World Service regularly offered the Alistair Cook program. I feel I owe him a lot for giving us such a witty and knowledgeable account of the American scene. He'll be sadly missed." And from Glasgow, Scotland, "Having lived and worked overseas as an expatriate much of my life, Alistair's voice has been a familiar one for years. His unique storytelling style and his personal slant on current topics made his letters unmissable. I've even stopped my car in order to hear his program better. Our best wishes to his family." As a politics tutor who played Letter from America to his students over a 25-year period, writes another listener from England, I can testify that his appeal spread across all ages and races. Each broadcast was a master class in controlled English and craftsmanship, deceptively well-informed. I used his talks as models for how students should cover a topic in detailed yet interesting manner. As to his humanity and love of liberty, it shone through every broadcast. He was a true legend of his era. And again, this hour of the Afternoon Magazine has been in remembrance of Alistair Cook, who passed away at the age of 95 early yesterday. For 58 years, he submitted his Letters from America. 2,869 in all. We have been airing them on Monday afternoons at 2:40, of course, here on AM 580, as well as other times through the weekend as we've aired the BBC World Service in the overnight hours. And at www.bbc.co.uk, you can link up to the World Service and then Letter from America. And they have a bulletin board there where you can write in your comments, your remembrances, your thoughts about Alistair. And we have time if somebody wanted to squeeze in at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. One more call or so before we need to wrap things up and get into our settlements and closing market report here on the Afternoon Magazine. Just a couple of more comments from the BBC site. From Sacramento, California, Alistair Cook helped make public television what it is today. I certainly remember as a young kid watching his introductions to Masterpiece Theater, often imitated over the years, even by PBS-own Sesame Street. His introductions were witty, yet clear and concise, setting the stage for the programs to come. Thank you, Mr. Cook, for helping us support you. And we have one more call that we can take from Matt Toon. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
You would like to know if Mr. Cook was ever married.
Yes. As a matter of fact, he was, and had two children. And I believe his wife and his children survive him. All right?
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. And that is information provided to us there by the BBC as well, which does indicate that he was married and with two children. So, Alistair Cook, 95 years old, just retired after submitting his final Letter from America earlier this month, just a few weeks ago. And we hope you have enjoyed the run of Letters from America that we have been able to bring you on AM 580. Again, we'll have some more from his archives coming up on Monday afternoons through the month of April. And thank you very much for your calls to those who did call in this afternoon as a part of this program. And thank you for listening to the tribute to Alistair Cook here on the Afternoon Magazine. Again, the half-hour program, which we heard from the BBC from a little after 1 o'clock until a little after 1:30, will be repeated at 6:30 this evening here on AM 580. I'm Jay Pierce, our technical director this afternoon, Jason Croft, and Harriet Williamson is the producer of the program. As the Afternoon Magazine continues at 2:40, we'll be talking about an upcoming open house at the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois, and also a special event to help benefit the Wildlife Medical Clinic. That'll be coming up in a conversation at 2:40 this afternoon. In the meantime, we have the highs, lows, and settlements from the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange and also the closing market report coming up, first of all, with the settlements from the Board of Trade at 1:50 Central Time. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Jay. Quite a day at the Chicago Board of Trade. Started out actually before the board even opened with the release of the prospective plannings and the grain stocks report. That would be the March 1st, or sometimes referred to as the quarterly grain stocks report from USDA. Here are the numbers as they came out this afternoon, or rather this morning. Let's take a look at them from the planted acreage report. 79 million acres is what the USDA says farmers will put in the ground in the nation this year in terms of corn, and that's just up slightly, but well below the trade average guesses, something closer to about 80 to 80.5 million acres there. And the impact, of course, was that the futures at the Chicago Board of Trade went a little bit higher, and the beans had a number that was 2 million acres higher than the previous year. And the guess is at 75,411 in terms of planted acreage from USDA. And that was quite a bit above what most of the trade expected from USDA this morning. And of course, the grain stocks report just as interesting, about on par with what producers and traders were expecting in terms of how much was in the pantry for corn at the March 1st point, but well above what they expected from the soy complex. So the beans were under pressure all day, as the reports this morning from USDA were bearish, and that showed up in both the new crop and the old crop. The new crop beans were down about a dime. The old crop were down 20 cents. In the corn and the wheat pits, futures were just the opposite. At least in the corn, they were higher, anywhere between 7 and 10 cents. And in the wheat, they were off just a bit for the day. The May contract there at 418 on the high, the low at 395, at a settlement price at 408. It finished the day down 7 1/4. July wheat futures, 422.5, the high for the day, the low at 401.5, a settlement price at 415 3/4, down 4.5. In September wheat, 424.5, the high, the low at 406.5, a settlement price at 420.5. They were down 2 on the day. December futures in wheat pit, 432.5, the high, the low at 414, a settlement price at 428 1/4, down 3. And the March futures, 432.5, the high, the low at 417, the settlement price at 431, finished the day a half lower. From the corn pit, May futures finished 7 3/4 cents higher, 321 3/4, the high, the low at 312 1/4, and a settlement price at 320. And once again, that settlement price up 7 3/4 cents. July futures, 327.5, the high, the low at 318, a settlement price at 325.5, and the July corn up 8 1/4. September contract, 322 3/4, the high, the low at 313, a settlement price at 320 1/4, up 9. And the December futures, 322, the high, the low at 311.5, a settlement price at 317 3/4. They finished up 11 cents for the day. March contract, 321, the high, the low at 313 1/4, a settlement price 318 3/4, up a dime. And the May futures, 321, the high, the low at 314.5. The new crop May settlement price, 320 1/4, up 10 3/4. July 05 corn, 320.5, the high, the low at 313.5, a settlement price there at 320 1/4. They finished up 10 3/4 for the day. And the December futures, 272.5, the high, the low at 269. December 05 corn, 270 3/4, a settlement price up 3 3/4. May oats now, 176, the high, the low at 170 3/4, a settlement at 174. They finished up 2. And the July 180.5 high, and the low at 175.5, settlement price at 178.5, and the July oats, they finished 1.5 cents higher on the day. From the soy complex, the nearby May bean contract off 21 1/4 cents, the high today at $10.15. But everything settled below $10 for the day. 981 was the high in the nearby, or the low in the nearby May, and it settled at 995. Quite a trading range that, once again, from 981 to 1015. The settlement price at 995, down 21 1/4 on the day. July futures, $10.07 on the high, the low, or rather, you know, $10.07 on the high, the low at 977, and a settlement price at 995. They were down 13. August, 957, the high, the low at 934. Settlement price there, 940, down 22. And the September futures, 842, the high, the low at 823. A settlement price, 835. They finished 15.5 lower. November futures in the bean pit, 754, the high, the low at 730. Your new crop settled 747, the harvest month down 10.5 cents. January soybeans, 751, the high, the low at 737. Settlement there, 749.5, down 5.5. And then March, 740, the high, the low at 728. Settlement, 740. They finished down 9 cents. May bean meal at 318, high, low at 307. Settlement price at 314.30, down 220. July meal, 317, the high, the low at 304. Settlement price at 310.50, down 310. May bean oil, 32.76, the high, the low at 32.05. Settlement price, 32.23, down 88. And the July futures for the bean oil, a 32.60 high, low at 31.95. And a settlement at 32.06. They finished the day 95 lower. Now here's Jay Pierce with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange. Jay?
Thank you very much, Todd. The March feeder cattle had a high today at 90.70, a low of 90.62.5. The settlement, 90.62.5, up 15. The April feeder cattle, 89.75 was the high. The low is 89 even. The settlement, 89.50, down 22.5. May, 87.30 for the high. 86.40 was the low. 87.15 the settlement, down 32.5. And the August feeder cattle closed down 52.5. 87.90 was the high. The low was 86.80, and the settlement 87.57.5. Again, down 52.5. April live cattle, the high was 80.05. The low 79.20. The settlement 79.82.5, unchanged. June, 76.35 for the high. The low was 75.25. The settlement 76.22.5, up 7.5. August live cattle, the high 75.20, the low 74.05, the settlement 75.10, up 20, and October finished unchanged, the high today 76.85, a low 76.15, the settlement 76.67.5, again unchanged on the October live cattle. April lean hogs had a high of 67.80, a low of 66.30, the settlement 66.65, down 115. May, the high 68.80, the low 67.55, the settlement 68.60, up 2.5. June lean hogs unchanged on the close today. The high 75, the low 73.55, the settlement 74.65, again unchanged. And July lean hogs had a high of 70.75, the low 69.55, the settlement 70.62.5, up 42.5. March pork bellies, a high at 113 today, low at 109, settlement at 109, down a dollar. And the May pork bellies, 109 for the high, 107.20 was the low today, 107.37.5 for the settlement, down 82.5. That's a look at how things wound up on the Mercantile Exchange.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A question about nutrition, Dr. Science, from Bob Pease in Hollywood, California. Dear Dr. Science, if we're not supposed to eat animals, how come they're made out of meat?
You know, until I did the research, I used to think it was just another one of those cruel cosmic jokes. The never-ending moral dilemma catching us between a rock and a hard place. Then I discovered what we think of as meat is merely a chewy form of polyethylene. Like most food-like substances, it's artificially flavored and texturized with soy protein and corn sweeteners added to give it that processed taste that we all take for granted nowadays. When you drive through farming regions, those animals you see behind the barbed-wired fences are actually owned by local tourist boards. And some are even mechanical. You can always tell the artificial cow from the others. She's facing the wrong way. So you see, progress has taken the sting out of most moral dilemmas.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.